Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 183rd episode of the John Mack Radio Show. The links to the previous, to the recordings of the previous 182 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com. And you'll find that under the radio show tab. As I've said for the last 6 months, my last piece for the Westchester Guardian, the 212th, is still available after more than the 6 months. That website, www.westchesterguardian.com. Westchester Guardian is WESTCHESTERGUARDIAN. It was hopefully left up there to be read by every living American, and I, of course, hope that they do. It's the last of the Credit Disruption series in the paper, as after the September 29th issue, the Westchester Guardian joined the ranks of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, the New York Journal American, and the Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. The issue also contained columns by ex-congressperson and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily free newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, technology, the environment, arts, entertainment, and opinion. Try and subscribe, only one email per day. I hope you'll join us not only tonight, the next week, when my guest is this author, radio commentator, a musician, entrepreneur, and founder of New York City's Echo online conferencing system, Stacey Horn, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings live, or as most do listeners later. Now to this week's show, the 183rd, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that's, once again, 646-716-9756. I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. And my guest tonight is author, writer, one of the best early internet books, The Matrix, proprietor of Oakwood Paradise Farms and Suwannee bookkeeper at WWALS Watershed Coalition, John S. Quarterman. Good evening, John. Welcome to the show.
Howdy, John. Greetings from Oakwood Paradise Farms, halfway between Atlanta and Orlando, and all the way to paradise.
Well, I gave a brief overview of your life and deleting. There's much to discuss as we flush out the details. So let's start right at the beginning. What does the S stand for in John S. Quarterman?
I had my wife convinced for a long time that it stood for shy. Then I tried to convince her it stood for subtle. Eventually, she didn't believe me anymore, so I told her it stands for Sinclair. Which actually is true. It's an old Scottish family going back. We can trace it to the year 800, not 1800, 800.
So does the Scottish background, I've been reading, I tend to binge read on mysteries, and I'm up to the 17th Ian Rankin Inspector Rebus series that's set in Edinburgh. I'm learning a lot about the culture and the geography there. Where did you grow up?
I figured you were going to mention Dan Brown. Yes, it is the same Sinclair family. And yes, I have stayed in Roslyn Castle. So, where did I grow up? Oh, well,
right.
Halfway between Atlanta and Orlando and all the way to paradise. I live on the same land I grew up on. My grandfather bought the farm, literally speaking, in 1921, about few more years and it'll be 100 years, a centennial family farm.
Wow. what were your interests as a young child? I know that music was one.
Yes, I played trombone in the high school band. I actually started in the middle school band because they didn't have enough people in the high school band, so the band director dragged me down there. You know, it's funny, after going to every single football game and most of the basketball games and as part of the band, I have never been to a football game since.
Where did you go to early school?
Oh, I went to elementary school in Pine Grove Elementary in Lowndes County, Georgia. I bet you can't spell that.
L-O-W-N-D-E-S.
It was a cheer in the high school. I went to middle school in Hayhira, Georgia. And I went to high school at Lowndes High School, which is in Valdosta, Georgia. Several places which, if you just saw them spelled and didn't know them, you probably could not pronounce. No one can.
I know that your mother taught in the school system. That what level did she teach?
Well, she taught first grade. She taught me in the first grade. You can tell that I didn't learn much. I come from a long line of school teachers. Her mother, her sisters, my father's two sisters. I decided early on I was not going to be a school teacher. Someone else could do that.
My brother was the college teacher, and I had him for two semesters in college. I got two A's, and he threw me out of class once. that you went off to Harvard on scholarship. Was the scholarship based on any particular aspect of your record?
My two principal schools I was applying to were Georgia Tech or Harvard. Harvard gave me a better scholarship because from their perspective, we were poorer. Same family, just different perspective. So I went off to the frozen north on that decision, and I never lived in the big city, had never been in a place where it seemed to snow all the time. I did find artists and musicians, which I tended to spend most of my time but somehow I got hooked up with the computer science program. Wasn't actually called that. It was a concentration in the engineering and applied physics division. Originally, they were going to call that applied physics and engineering, but they didn't really think Go Ape would be a good motto. So I first used ARPANET in 1974 while getting that degree in computer science.
Yeah, I was a number of years before you, and I was an English major. I'd never seen a computer, didn't know anything, had no interest in them, and I was extremely lucky to get into a government pilot program that I wound up spending 50 years with technology. And my wife went to Penn State, and they did not have a computer science program, even though she had exposure to computers when she was in high school in Philadelphia. They worked on the theoretical machine at Penn. So, had you gotten into computers before you went to Harvard? Had you gotten into them in school?
Well, there were not many computers back in the farm. Unlike a TA who turned up later, Mr. Gates, he had, as you probably know, done a lot of computing before he ever got there, which is how he was a teaching assistant the first year that he was there. I first saw a computer when I was in Harvard. PDP-8s, still like those things. Paper tape, Space War, on a PDP-1 down at MIT, you haven't lived till you use toggle switches to navigate a spaceship around on a circular CRT screen.
Sure, sure. Well, my children had some of the early game machines, and you did things like that then. Some of the early ones didn't have keyboards. So we went from the mainframe with toggle machines, like on the ENIAC, through keyboard interfaces, and then when personal computer kids came along, it was the same thing. We started way back in the beginning, and we kept going forward. So, you took off a year after graduation, and you went to the West Coast. What was that about?
No. That was before graduation. I took a year off for bad behavior and went off to the West Coast and got to know some people in Silicon Valley, but did not have a real job there. It was kind of interesting, but I got ready to go back to school, so I did that and went back and finished up. And so it took 5 years instead of four. Turns out they told me that's not that uncommon, about 30%. At Harvard, I did take that off.
I did too. I started off as a philosophy major, and then I saw that there weren't many jobs in New York Times for philosophers, so I switched to something much more practical, English literature. And
my two favorite courses at Harvard were in English and philosophy. The English one was about John Milton's Paradise Lost.
Okay. And the philosophy?
I actually don't remember what it was called, but it was about epistemology. How do you actually know anything? And I should remember the specific conundrum they came up with, but it was kind of eye-opening. Well, no, we don't actually know, because all you really know is sense perceptions. And, there's a lot of stuff from there, but we didn't get a lot of exposure to that down in the piney woods of South Georgia, so it was quite interesting.
It's funny because many, many basic philosophy courses are extremely different. My wife was just a math major at Penn State, and her philosophy course was taught out of the math department, and it was really logical thinking. It was philosophical logic. I went to a Catholic school, and it started out with Aristotle and with ways that got us into thinking about who we were, and as you said, epistemology. You were also coincidentally at the first meeting of what became Unisnix, and you also, as you mentioned, you had Gatesford, our teaching assistant. How did these all happen?
Oh, well, Unix was being used at Harvard, so there was a group that got together about that. And Gates, as you know, went off to Harvard to get a degree, and he already had a lot of experience back from home, so he got to be a teaching assistant. He was a pretty good teaching assistant, I remember that much. I didn't wonder what happened to him, only found out later about how he had gone off to write a basic implementation,
and wound up and wound up down in the Southwest originally.
Yep.
With Paul Allen.
Yep. And there was at least one other guy who had been involved in the computer science program there that went off there, but we got a little far afield there. So eventually, I escaped Harvard and went off to work for BBM.
Yeah, they were the prime derision, the contractors on the internet. Tell us about that work.
Well, it was the ARPANET. At that time, the internet hadn't been invented yet. And I'd known that BBN did this because there were some people who had taught stuff at Harvard about that. And so that was one of the places I applied to get a job. And fortunately, I did. And I learned a little bit about TCP/IP because it was starting up around the time I was there, but I also learned some other stuff. Remember Colossal Cave Adventure? The very first online adventure game written in Fortran on a PDP-10 at BBN in 1975. If you've read Lord of the Rings, it's like a treasure hunt, which is very reminiscent of some of the things you see in Lord of the Rings, and then it got rewritten as Zork and Dungeon. A lot of that going on.
Do also, at about the same time, from the note that you sent me, you got into both social activism and world travel around that time. Tell us about these activities.
Yes. Well, I forgot to mention in the write-up I sent you that while at BBN I was consulting at a certain place south of Maryland. There's no such agency, of course.
Okay.
And at the same time, I was protesting at the Seabrook nuclear plant in New Hampshire. That was the beginnings of the anti-nuclear movement. I was not in at the beginning. I was, you know, I came in as just one of the protesters well along, but it was a very, very interesting experience. And I'm proud to say I helped distribute flyers in the New York City area in 1979 on the 50th anniversary of the 1929 stock market crash. There was something called Take It to Wall Street, which started with a demonstration in a park across near the stock exchange, and then the next day a bunch of people got arrested at the stock exchange. I was not one of the ones that got arrested, but it was still a very interesting experience. It didn't stop them from opening that day because they got tunnels under the street just in case of that eventuality. But what it really did was it kicked off a different phase. The protests had ramped up from, you know, just a few at Seabrook to thousands to tens of thousands, and that still didn't stop the construction. So this was a different tack. Go to the money. Go to who's financing it. Without the financing, it won't happen. Now, as it turns out, one of the Seabrook nukes did finally get built, only one of the two. But Public Service of New Hampshire eventually, because of this and some other tactics, went bankrupt. And Richard Nixon, remember Tricky Dicky? He had promised us there would be thousands of nuclear plants throughout the country generating at least 30% of the country's power by the year 2000. Do you see thousands? I don't. Never happened. Peaked at about 104, is going down. And this activism at Seabrook, and once again, I was just a bit player. I had nothing to do with organizing it, but except, as I say, I'm proud to say I helped distribute flyers for Ticket to Wall Street in 1979. And that tactic has stuck with me ever since.
I'm getting a bit ahead of myself. When we talk about nuclear power, one of the interesting things going on in my area, I'm in northern Westchester, in New York, and they announced the deal with the governor, Andrew Cuomo, that they're going to decommission Indian Point, which has two nuclear reactors. And it's responsible for about 25% of the power in the New York City area. One of the fallouts is that some of the local towns here get their total tax revenue from Indian Point, and they're scrambling. So what do we do to fund the schools and everything? So it's one of these complex issues that obviously we wanted to get rid of because there is some danger from it. There's been leakage, and at the same time, it's going to create problems for other things in the area. So we're going to have to deal with
well,
that.
And there's, and you know, I see you're getting ahead of the story, and I leap ahead in two ways. One is within a few thousand feet of Indian Point, Spectra Energy of Houston, Texas, is approved to build a humongous natural gas pipeline. What could possibly go wrong? That's the same company that's building a natural gas pipeline through the county that I live in, through Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. And this too large centralized idea of Indian Point and the nuclear plants and the big baseload capacity energy plants, coal, natural gas, and so forth, is a problem in the same way that the over-centralization of the telephone network used to be, and in the over-centralization we seem to be seeing now in the internet. So energy, the telephone network of old times, and the internet, there's a lot of similar themes.
All right. Do also, when traveling to Africa, what caused the interest there? That's a long way from the Florida Georgia border.
Well, I think it has to do with a globe that my brother had when I was growing up, which was an old one. It showed this very large blue area over Africa labeled French West Africa. And it also had to do, I had a girlfriend who went over there in the Peace Corps. So I went over to visit her. I actually learned French so I could do this. I hired a tutor from from Quebec. The accents don't mesh all that well. So I went off to visit once, and then I went back again. I spent like 6 months on the second trip. It was, you know, not a happy ending in the sense that she wasn't there anymore because she had met with a traffic accident. The irony, all the way to Africa to die in a traffic accident, but I don't dwell on that. So anyway, it's very eye-opening to see all these different countries, and some of them were very similar when you're heading to the next country. Oh, don't go there. It's so horrible. You'll be robbed. You get there and they say, I can't believe you came from there. It's so horrible.
Yeah, sure. Big cities in the United States.
Oh, and I mostly avoided the big cities when I could. But anyway, go ahead.
And then you wound up in Austin, Texas, where I first heard of you. What brought you to Austin?
Well, when I got back from Africa, I systematically looked around for a number of criteria. One of them was, does not snow all the time. Another was ARPANET connection. And there were some others like music. And, hey, Austin, Texas fits all those bills. So I found a job there and moved. And before long, I ended up at the University of Texas because, hey, internet connection, and they needed somebody to help them stay on the internet because in 1983, there was the great changeover from the ARPANET protocols to the TCP/IP protocol, so I helped them with that.
Yeah, and you also wound up on the board of Usenix, and you met your future wife there, who is also a Unix person. How'd that happen?
Yeah, well, how did I get on the board? Well, they needed people from an academic background, and at that time I was working for the university, and I was relatively well-known because of Usenet. Remember Usenet?
Sure.
Yeah, I happened to be running the second largest node on Usenet, the first one being at DEC. My node was called UT-Sally after a comic character. Anyway, so I was very well known, and I got nominated, and I got elected. And my wife, Gretchen, she's in the next room here, pretending she's not hearing what we're talking about. She was working at the university at Buffalo, and she was traveling around in the same circles going to Usenix. We still differ. Was it a conference in D.C. or Baltimore? We know which series of parties we met at, which I won't go into. This is probably a family show. And, one thing led to another. Actually, I took her to three different continents before we settled on Time Knot.
You also got involved with the Austin science fiction community, and you met William Gibson, the author of Neuromancer, and one of my favorite people, the multi-talented and very funny Bruce Sterling. Tell us about that involvement.
Yeah, you got to get Bruce on here. I'm sure he could make up a better story about anything I'm telling you than what actually happened, and it would be more enjoyable. Well, the funny thing about science fiction societies is, like a lot of volunteer outfits, if you show up and are willing to do work, hey, you're drafted. You get to help run conferences and stuff like that. So that's what happened. So Bill Gibson's book was, I found impressive for a number of reasons. A lot of people found it impressive. It won lots of awards and so forth. But because the visualization aspect, trying to visualize networks, and his generalist approach to it, and, of course, the name The Matrix, which he used for all the networks, which I adopted later.
Bill, he's a little too dark for me. I prefer Sterling, and I prefer some of the other writers about it, like Neal Stephenson. But I recognize his value in publicizing the net. The growth of the internet and your own writing background that led to the compilation and publishing of 770 page book, The Matrix. I still have a few copies. Tell us about that effort.
Well, it actually started as a 10-page paper. People kept asking me, people at UT and people through Usenet, you know, what are all these networks? How are they related? You know, things most people have never heard of, BitNet, FidoNet, UCP, Usenet, CSNet. So I took to writing up a thing, and it grew to 10 pages, and I, you know, asked people all over the net because, like, I didn't know, like, FidoNet, how does that work? I found a contact. Okay, and it got... And, oh, I forgot to mention this part. It's turned into a 40-page paper in Communications at the ACM, which for computing science people is a relatively prestigious journal.
Yep.
At that point, I noted I could just fold it in half and it would be a book. So I went around looking for a book publisher, found one. And it was not intended to be a 770-page paper, but book is going to be more like maybe 300. I did not get a lot of reaction first out of people running networks in the States. I was like, a book? Why? What are you doing? So I used a tactic I found useful for other things. I went to Europe. I had some contacts there because of Usenix. There's a thing in Europe similar to that called EUNet, which I'd been to. So I used those contacts to start getting introductions from one place to another across Europe where people were running various kinds of networks. So that resulted in several couch surfing trips. And I got material for basically all the European networks. I got introductions. I got stuff from Japan. I got stuff from Korea. Okay, so it became time to wrap this thing up. And at that point, the stateside networks realized, oh, you're really doing it. And suddenly, masses of material came in, and it was solid stuff. So I cleaned it up, and we published it, 770 pages. And not bad for a tiny little, or, okay, not tiny, but obscure technical reference book. It sold about 50,000 copies.
You also then wrote other books about the Internet and Unix. This was a time when new Internet users, they were hungry for information. You also projected that the Internet would grow exponentially over the next 10 years, an unlikely prediction at the time that now stands with Moore's Law and its accuracy. What gave the confidence for such a prediction?
Well, the early Internet, nobody was bothering to keep records, really. Nobody cared about preserving things for history. So me and Mark Lauder was collecting some data, and I was collecting some data. And between us, we kept track of how many computers were connected to first the ARPANET and then the Internet. It became increasingly difficult to do that. But anyway, we had the records. If you start looking at the records, it became clear pretty quickly, early 1990s, that the other networks were not really going to be able to compete, and the Internet itself was doubling in size at a fairly frequent, fast clip. I'd have to actually go look to say what the number of months was. And it was steadily doing an exponential increase like that. And when you got something like that, it's not hard, really, to project it ahead. You can't project it ahead forever. I mean, eventually there's not enough computers left in the world. But I did what I deliberately called a naive projection of 10 years, and it turns out 10 years later I was within a factor of 2, which ain't bad for a 10-year projection.
Sure. You also were publishing a Matrix News, and you also had a company that then turned into the venture capital funded after MatrixNet, and you say that briefly survived the 2000 Internet bust. What happened then? Why did it fall apart?
Oh, well, that's a long story. But you notice the Matrix name. And yes, I asked Bill Gibson, can I use it? And he said yes. But, you know, the really interesting stuff was what that was about. It was building on the same kind of data I had been collecting. This is different from the number of computers data. This was using ping. Remember ping?
Sure.
Where you send out a packet, you get a response. And what we did was we counted the latency interval. How many milliseconds did it take to go there and come back? It turns out by carefully selecting where you're sending these pings, you can map the internet. So we did that. And an early application of that was just, you know, tracking the latency average over time, which led to why I got Bob Metcalf to eat his hat. He claimed way back then that the internet was going to fall apart because it was not centrally managed like AOL. But he had no data. He eventually came to me because nobody else had the data, and we went back and ran the data and made him graphs over several years, and the latency was going down, i.e. the performance was improving. So he literally ate his hat. Okay, so we expanded on that. We parallelized it. We added marketing and all that kind of stuff. And by we, I mean then the VCs got in and had their people do all that. Okay, so what this is about is finding out the big picture of how the internet is performing, which is about communications, about how things fit together, about differences of performance amongst different ISPs, which led to a whole theme of, you know, who's written about this kind of thing before? And it turns out military strategists, Clausewitz, Jomini, and my favorite, John R. Boyd, and, you know, over different centuries, they built on that, from just massing forces to lines of communication to managing energy. We could easily talk for 5 hours about that, so I'll probably stop about there.
You also got involved, or you came across Alan Ostrom's the Nobel Prize work on management of the commons. Can you give us a brief overview of that?
Well, that's the fault of my Aunt Elsie, who was a professor of plant ecology at Vanderbilt University. You've probably heard of the old canard about the tragedy of the commons. Well, it is a canard. It's not real in the sense that the, you know, there was that one paper that claimed, well, it's always going to be a problem because, you know, cows will overgraze the commons. Well, the Eleanor Ostrom did the research. There are centuries and centuries of real commons, including exactly that kind of thing, the village green with people grazing cows on them. And they survive for centuries. How can that be? Well, it has to do with things like transparency. If you're grazing your cows on there, everyone else sees you're grazing your cows. If you start grazing a lot of cows, everyone sees you're grazing more cows than anyone else. And when you go down to the pub, they're going to start remarking on it. So that's part of it, transparency and communications amongst those who are actually the active participants. That's one of the most important things. And it does help. There is a role for government. As in, you know, maybe there's like rules for how many people can graze how many cows. And if you're really not going to listen to your neighbors, then maybe they call in the law. So, you know, what her stuff is about, and this is greatly to oversimplify, is any real commons tends not to be wholly private nor wholly public. There's a role for each of that. And transparency and communication have a lot to do with it. And, you know, shades of the internet, shades of energy markets.
Not the shades of fake news, for instance. So everything that looks transparent all of a sudden is dismissed as fake news. After seemingly having deep roots in Austin, you and Gretchen moved back to your early roots in Georgia about 10 years ago. What brought that on?
Well, I inherited half the farm.
Oh, okay.
And also back in Austin, we had 85 acres east of Austin, but the state of Texas in its infinite wisdom decided they wanted to build a 4-lane highway through the corner. We didn't particularly fancy having 90-foot-high lights shining in our window at night, so we sold out and moved back to Georgia.
And you mentioned that you expected just to do your own thing, riding, to not bothering anyone, but all of a sudden you moved into the leading role in both environmentalism and solar power use and advocacy, leading to your present responsibilities as river keeper. I'm sorry. Take us down that path while pronouncing many locations that I can't.
Well, we are hermits. We live in the woods, or that was our plan. But 1 month after we moved back in, the neighbor said, "Have you seen that red sign?" "What sign?" "A rezoning sign for a subdivision next to your west field." Oh, my goodness. So I got to go around and meet each of the neighbors one by one up close and personal, and we did manage to fight that off. The chairman of the county commission at the time said that was the most people on any side he'd ever seen, and the county commission did not actually vote on the rezoning. Later, he claimed that he had gotten death threats. It was not from our side. But he did loudly announce the rezoning is denied because they did not vote for it. Yay! Okay, so, and in 2009, you asked me to follow up on the rest of it. In South Georgia, there was a 700-year flood. And that was in 2009. And in 2013, there was another 700-year flood. Does that seem odd to you? It does to me. 700 years is only a few years apart. Okay, that was because things had changed. It's not like it was back in the 60s when I left, and then a huge amount of clear-cutting of woods, and particularly in the county seat, Valdosta, there's been a lot of impervious surfaces, parking lots, roads, and so forth. And funny thing, when you take down the trees and pave over everything, water runs off really quickly. So that's a lot of the reason for the floods. And there were other effects, like there were some bridges closed that shouldn't have been because trees that naturally had fallen down in the creeks and rivers had never been moved, and the county and the city, state were finger-pointing, you know, who should do this. It's a commons management problem. Eleanor Ostrom.
Right. What did you do about it?
Well, first we looked around. Where's the riverkeeper? Can we call a riverkeeper? There was none. So then we looked around. Where are the population centers? I did not know this. That's how ignorant I am. That's a common theme that keeps coming up. I cannot believe how ignorant I am. We were living in the largest population center for the entire Suwannee River Basin in both Georgia and Florida. And the second largest is two counties to the north, Tift County, with Tifton, and the third largest is also in Georgia, Colquitt County, and Moultrie. It's not in Florida. No one seems to know that unless they've studied it, even people who live here. Okay, so us, and there are a whole bunch of other threads. I actually wrote this up recently for a different reason, but let's just say Tift County and Lowndes County and a bunch of other people, we formed something in 2012 called Walls Watershed Coalition to advocate the conservation and stewardship of the, here's where the acronym comes from, with the Coochie, Willacoochee, Alapaha, Little, and the Suwannee River watersheds in South Georgia and North Florida through education, awareness, environmental monitoring, and citizen activities. And we slowly ramped up, and that's how that started.
Now, what exactly is a riverkeeper, John?
Okay, leaping ahead, in December 2016, we got the license to be Suwannee Riverkeeper. The trademark on Riverkeeper is owned by Waterkeeper Alliance. The very first Riverkeeper was on the Hudson River.
Where I live.
Exactly. And Pete Seeger was heavily involved in that. Bobby Kennedy Jr. was involved from the very beginning until he just left them, like last month.
And Don McLean, who went to my college.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Okay, so it started, and this is a long, hairy story, which I've heard Bobby Kennedy tell at great length, but basically, back when it started, there was a fishermen's association, and they were pretty much out of a job because the river was so polluted, there were no fish anymore. So they were, like, thinking of desperate measures, like, let's just blow up that pipe that's putting the stuff into the water, until one of them discovered, hey, wait, this is law that says that if you find a polluter and blow them in, you can get a reward. So that's what they did instead, funded their activities. And I don't remember the exact details, but that morphed into the original Riverkeeper, which is still around. In fact, it's the only one called just Riverkeeper. But there are now 300 waterkeepers worldwide. And I'm proud to say Suwannee Riverkeeper is one of the newest ones.
Now, how much responsibility
do?
Right. How much responsibility does the Riverkeeper have?
All and none. Are we actually required to do anything? No. We are volunteers. We are not a governmental body. We're a 501c3. That's part of the requirements. You have to be a 501c3. We're an educational organization. We're not actually required to do anything. But people expect you to do things like I got a reference to a restaurant raising gooses with their leavings too close to a river that I'm going to look into. I also got a reference to a power plant. I don't want to say that one too loudly right now because I got to look into the details first that's putting stuff into the river. And of course, there's the infamous pipeline we'll get to in a moment. But, you know, the motto of Waterkeeper Alliance is fishable, drinkable, swimmable. Trying to keep all the rivers like that. And a lot of river keepers spend a lot of time litigating, suing people. We don't do that so much because mostly we do not have a lot of what you call single force point pollution. We don't have an Indian Point leaking radioactive materials into the river. We don't have Altima River Keeper has Rainier, a huge timber treatment plant. We don't mostly have that. What we do have is a lot of agriculture and forestry, and they're our good neighbors. For example, Tuesday at Valdosta State University at 6 p.m., if there's anybody listening in the Suwannee River Basin, come on down to Valdosta State University, 6 p.m. We'll be talking about water, agriculture, and forestry. So what we mostly do is politics, trying to get people to talk to each other, trying to influence state and national and local agencies. That's what we do.
The big issue in the Hudson for a while, and I think that they finally came to some arrangements, was the leakage from the General Electric plants up around Syracuse, the PCPs in the water. And I think that they eventually did get GE to be responsible for removing them. While I have you on rivers, do you know anything about what's going on in this famous North Carolina Duke Power thing, which was supposedly that they're not responsible for cleaning up the leakage in the water?
You're talking about coal ash, right?
I think so, yeah.
We have that problem. Yes, we have that problem. It turns out in the landfill in Lowndes County, there is coal ash from both Tennessee and Florida. And the Georgia legislature just failed to pass a bill that would have at least required public notification when, and perhaps an extra permit before putting coal ash into a landfill. Right now, it's just like household trash. You do not even have to have a permit, no public notification. We also have PCBs in this landfill. We know because they did get fined for that. We also have wastewater from a Superfund. And Georgia Power, like every other utility, is now ramping down coal plant use, which means they got all these coal ash ponds and they want to send them somewhere. They want to send them to local landfills. Bad idea, I think. My opinion and the opinion of Wolves is that the organizations that produce the coal ash ought to pay out of their pocket or their ratepayers, if they must, to fund safe places to put them on their own property without sending it to the rest of us to deal with.
And do you see that moving along? Is there public interest in this throughout the country, or is it always too much of a local issue that the people in Arizona don't care about Georgia's problem or
commons management problem?
Right.
That's an issue that I was talking about with other water keepers just the other day. Coal ashes, for example. This, you know, it's North Carolina, it's Tennessee. You probably heard about the big busted coal ash pond some years ago. Come back, came to our landfill. It's Florida. Turns out Tallahassee used to have coal ash, which it sent to Thomasville, Georgia. It's Jacksonville. And if you end up with individual water keepers just dealing with their territory or just their state, you know, it's just being reactionary. So we need to get beyond that. We need to take a more inclusive view. We need to look at it as a national and international commons problem. And it's part of the much larger energy commons problem.
Speaking of energy, why don't you take us in to both your use of solar power and your promotion of it?
Okay, way back in 2003, Austin Energy, which for many years had been saying, solar power, that's no use to us. Austin at the time was the fastest growing city in the country, ridiculous growth rate, 10% a year. They really had to get new electricity. So they looked at, what if we get a buy into a coal plant? Austin's supposed to be clean industry city, can't do that. What about a nuke? Well, they tried that in the 80s, way late, way over budget, like the ones Georgia Power is building right now on the Savannah River. And huge political opposition, ain't touching that again. So they finally just ran the numbers on solar panels and discovered for the same money they'd have to pay to get into a coal plant, they could do rebates to business and homeowners to put them on their roof and get just as much power and get it distributed so it wouldn't all go out at the same time. And it would generate the most in the middle of the afternoon when people's air conditioners were on. So suddenly, we're for solar power, and they did the first and most aggressive rebate in the country, 75%. So we got 20 solar panels and put them on our roof. Then we moved, and we had to pay some of it back because we had 5 years. But anyway, we brought them with us and put them on our farm workshop roof. And in 2012, we applied and got a USDA REAP grant, I think it's the Renewable Energy for Agriculture program. Still going, by the way, got 25% from that, and that was the last year. The 30% federal allocation was an actual grant. So we used that to help fund it, and we got 60 more solar panels on the farm workshop roof. So now we have 15 kilowatts of solar power, the biggest on our electric membership co-op. And we got drawn into solar power policy for Georgia about that time, as well as Watershed Coalition, because Georgia was one of the very few states that did not allow, here's some jargon for you, you think the internet's got jargon, power purchase agreements, third-party power purchase agreements. Basically, it made it hard to finance solar power. But the Sierra Club and others organized statewide lobbying of the Georgia Public Service Commission. This is something you would not think would actually work, because 4 out of 5 of those members get like 80 to 90% of their campaign finance funds from people who work for the industries they regulate. Nonetheless, they bought it, and I'm proud to say, once again, I helped. I and another Wells board member testified in June 2013 and in July 2013. We were just some of the many people helping. Georgia Public Service Commission required Georgia Power to buy twice as much solar power as it wanted to, and they did that again in 2015. And Georgia Power in 2015 backed a change in that antique law that prohibited third-party power purchase agreements and changed it. So now Georgia is the fastest-growing U.S. solar market, and that's a really good thing.
Didn't you also
Florida to do the same? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Didn't you also have a dust up in Florida with legislation trying to go the other way?
Yeah, I didn't have a lot to do with that directly, but some of the same people who helped get the law changed in Georgia went into Florida and tried to get a petition to have a constitutional amendment on the ballot. Turns out in Florida, the PSC alone apparently can't do it. And that was going well, except the fossil fuel companies and the utilities got wind of it and spent tens of millions of dollars on a fake petition, which looked like it was for solar power but wasn't. The people of Florida saw through that and November 2016 voted down the fake solar power referendum. Yay! Which shows the people of Florida want solar power, and SolarCity, which does financing, installation, everything, top to bottom. They opened an office in Florida shortly after that.
They're in New York too, and New York had just a very big rebate program. I don't know what they still do, but they had a very big rebate program. I understand for Alton Energy that both Iowa and Texas, they're very big and wind turbine. How do you see all this coming together to replace the fossil fuels, the wind and the solar and the ocean, hopefully?
Well, we don't have a lot of wind in Georgia or Florida, but there is actually a lot of wind offshore in the Atlantic, which then someday Georgia Power will get around to doing something about. And, you know, don't say hurricanes. TEPCO in Japan is doing it, and they have hurricanes there. They just call them by a different name. In 2013, I noticed a similar thing to back in 1993 when I made that internet prediction. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, known as FERC, F-E-R-C, collects data about where energy is coming from in this country to generate electricity. And I observed that solar power was doubling every 2 years in this country. So, okay, do a naive projection ahead again. And it shows in 10 years, more U.S. electricity will come from solar power than anything else. And a few months later, I discovered the chair of FERC at that time, John Wellinghoff, made the same prediction from the same numbers. And the FERC's own numbers since then show it's going faster than that. So far, we are right. Now, Wellinghoff, of course, developed enemies pretty quickly for making that prediction, and they came up with an alleged conflict of interest, and he had to resign. But still, he was right. And in fact, last year, in 2016, more new U.S. electricity came from solar power than any other source, more than wind, more than natural gas. That's adding in not just the utility scale solar that FERC counts, but also rooftop business and housetop and community solar. That's the first time, but it is not going to be the last. We're well on track to exactly what was predicted. And fortunately for all of us, there's a fellow at Stanford named Mark Z. Jacobson, who has a research group that spent years studying this stuff. And he has plans for each and every U.S. state and most of the countries in the world for how to power everything, sun, wind, and water power, and nothing else. No coal, no natural gas, no nukes, no nothing else, just sun, wind, and water power. You can find that at thesolutionprojects.org, thesolutionsproject.org, Mark Z. Jacobson of Stanford. And given that, A, solar power has already won the economic race. Did I mention the solar industry now employs more people than coal, oil, and natural gas combined?
No, I did not know that.
It's true. And so solar power has already won the economic race, and we know how to use sun, wind, and water power and nothing else to power everything. By everything, I mean even transportation by 2050 and converting the electric grid much sooner than that. These pipelines that are being built, for example, by Indian Point and that Sable Trail pipeline boondoggle through Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, which would get its fracked gas from Pennsylvania, by the way.
Right.
They're totally unnecessary. The only excuse for these pipelines is corporate greed. It's a dying industry trying to cash in before it goes belly up. Coal is already crashing. Coal companies in this country are now 10% the market cap they were 10 years ago. And nuclear, it peaked at about 104 reactors, and it's down to less than 100 and going down rapidly, Indian Point, for example. And what people should do about that lost revenue at Indian Point is get into solar and wind, get in now. That's what they should do.
By the way, if you'll send me the URLs and the names of these various sites and organizations, I'll include them in the article that will go out about the interview.
I will.
To everyone. The other thing that I've read about that I haven't seen much about is is wave energy from the ocean trying to capture a similar thing that we do to the waterfalls like in Niagara Falls and everything. What do you know about that technology?
It probably will happen. It probably won't be a huge component, but it will be there. An important thing to realize about solar power is people go, well, there's a new technology coming along. Yeah, sure, there's lots of new technologies coming along. But the reason solar power is doubling every year has nothing to do with new technologies. It's pure economies of scale. Because so many people are buying it, it's becoming cheaper because, you know, the manufacturing is becoming more efficient, and simply the more you buy, the more you can sell at a lower price. And the one new technology that's coming along faster than people thought is batteries. I have paid my down payment to hold 2 Tesla Powerwalls for my 15 kilowatts. Most people have only need one. And they're not the only company selling batteries. They're also selling at utility scale. Even Southern Company, the parent of Georgia Power, is into that. So solar power, you know, panels, you know, they're already here. We don't need new technologies. We just need to deploy them. And then there will be new technologies on top of that. So wave power, yes, that will help add to the mix. I'm for that too.
The interesting thing, and it comes back now to a policy and a technology thing, when we mentioned the taxes at in the Indian Point area or the employment in the coal industry and others, there does not seem to be a concern in policymakers talking about it that there's tremendous disruption due to technology, whether it's if you walk through the mall and there are no more bookstores, there are no more record stores, or film processing stores because digital cameras ate those, and iTunes ate the others, and Amazon ate the others, that we don't seem to know what we're going to do about this problem, and policy changes. Robert Reich talks about it. 2 professors from MIT that I've written extensively. The Secretary of the Treasury said yesterday that this whole thing about the impact of robotics and intelligent learning is completely overrated. That's not going to happen in the next 20 years, perhaps not for 50 to 100. What's the answer to the policy changes? How do we get people interested in the seismic change in the way that we do business, the way that we pay taxes, the way that we work in the United States?
Well, I think Robert Reich is great, and I love his approach of he draws it on the blackboard while he's talking, which helps get it across. The reason I'm harping on solar power and how it's already won the economic race is you'd be amazed how many people had not heard any of that. And it's not really to the interest of the general mass media to write a lot about it. I mean, it's not like they're not covering it entirely. I can point you at a bunch of articles, but, you know, it's not front page news because, you know, the solar industry is not who's mostly paying for their ads. So the first thing we can do is get people to realize it's a problem and there are solutions. Now, you might think, you know, coal country in West Virginia, that's not prime solar power area. But the leader in solar power in the world is Germany, which is north of New York State. If Germany can do it, you know, a mountainous, cold, snowy Germany, then West Virginia can do it. It is, as you say, really a policy question. And, you know, if the federal government isn't going to deal with it, which right now looks like they're not going to do any better than the previous administration about this kind of problem in, for example, West Virginia, then, okay, well, we're going to have to depend on state and local government and entrepreneurs like, you know, Tesla and Elon Musk, which, you know, we need a better mix than that. We can't just depend on a few entrepreneurs to fix this. But, you know, right now we'll take what we can get, and, you know, you're helping by doing this show, so a few more people will hear about what's going on.
My concern is, though, people aren't even talking about the the impact of technology on employment, whether it's the guy who was in charge of chemical engineering for Kodak, to whether it's the tellers in the banks aren't there anymore because of the ATMs and the online banking. There are people talking about guaranteed annual wages. There are people talking about other things, but there just seems to be no interest in our political policymakers. And what I see is the major problem for our workforce.
Right. Well, it's the same reason they don't get solar power. Yeah, I can point you at umpteen projections forwards of solar power, and almost every one of them takes like last year's growth rate and linearly projects it forward like the same amount the next year and the next year, and that's not how it's working. I'm fond of whipping my smartphone out of my pocket and asking, how many of you had one of these 10 years ago? And of course, no one did. They didn't exist 10 years ago. I'm going to have to change that pretty soon because I forget what month Apple came out with the first iPhone. Okay, how many of you had one of these 5 years ago? Not many. It's the kind of thing that people are not used to because it doesn't happen that often. You know, smartphones, you know, mobile phones themselves, PCs, and the internet itself. I mean, you can name some examples, but mostly a small number that fits on the fingers of one hand. So most policymakers are not used to dealing with that kind of thing. They don't understand it when they see it right in front of them. As far as automation, I'm no expert on that, but I mean, if anybody thinks it's going to be a century away, you know, as you say, look at ATMs. And if they think that high-end knowledge-based occupations are going to be more immune than anything else, look at newspapers. So it's a big problem, and policymakers should be dealing with it. I guess maybe when so one thing that's starting to happen is policymakers are discovering right now that a lot more people are showing up at their town halls and are not willing to put up with these canned stuff that are being fed. And they also cannot hide what happens under a rock because it gets videoed in Facebook Live and sent to YouTube. As policymakers begin to realize, you know, the people can be more organized than they are, maybe they'll start to get a clue.
I hope you're right. What's next for you?
Oh, well, what's next for me is I'm going to continue building the Suwannee Riverkeeper organization, not just me, of course. I mean, we've been mostly talking about me because I don't like to talk about other people without, you know, talking to them first. You mentioned Amazon. I'm going to talk about Jeff Bezos briefly because I did not know this till long after the fact when his biographer contacted me. Bezos made a point of telling his biographer, hey, I got the idea to do this internet thing from that Matrix Information and Directory Services, you know, in Austin, Texas. What? Turns out it was a graph I did. It was like a year after I made that internet growth prediction. Then we started doing graphs of the growth of specific internet services, FTP, email, and the World Wide Web. And when Bezos saw the one of the web and saw it going up like a rocket, not just exponential, like a rocket, I can't think of a better phrase right now, he decided that was the place he wanted to do a business. You never know what you're doing that might actually finally get through to somebody.
He was an officer of the brokerage firm of D.F. Shaw in New York. They were doing computer models and everything. He actually hired a friend of mine, and then he went off to do Amazon. And we saw, you're absolutely right. If it weren't for the spreadsheet, there wouldn't have been personal computers also businesses. And if it weren't for the World Wide Web, computers wouldn't have gotten into the house. And the change in marketing between 1993 and the 1998, when everything was sold through the web, was just amazing. And a lot of people don't recognize that these are very short-term things that disrupt everything. You know? So,
Well, it's like in the late 19th century, way into the early 1900s, into the 1910s, people were going, how are we going to deal with all the horse manure collecting in cities, growing cities like New York City? They didn't realize that automobiles were going to change all that really quickly. That's the kind of change we're seeing right now with solar power and the subject you're bringing up, which, as I say, is not one that I know a lot about, but, you know, automation and robotics. I mean, you just look at any manufacturing. You know, we're not going to have all the jobs come back from China and Korea. The jobs don't exist anymore. They've been automated by robots.
Sure. And we're not going to have the middle management jobs that are responsible for doing the initial credit screenings and the initial this and the initial that. We have to deal with it. You know, it's very interesting, as they say. It's an interesting management and policy question.
Well, to wrap back to philosophers, I'm sure you know Bertrand Russell. You probably read his essay, In Praise of Idleness.
Sure. Sure.
Why should everybody work 8 hours a day, or 10 or 20, as too many people do? Why should everybody have to do that? If people worked like 4 hours a day, A, there'd be a lot more work to go around, and B, people would be a lot happier, and C, there'd be a lot more volunteer work going on. Now, would that require something like a basic wage to do it? Probably.
And that would be that would be terribly fought by the people making all the money, because they'd have to be carrying people that weren't making any money. John Maynard Keynes.
Well, would it? You know. Yes. Mm-hmm.
John Maynard Keynes said much
I know
the same
who he
thing
is, yes.
as Russell. He said it would be to a 25-hour a week sometime a long time ago, but that hasn't happened, obviously. So.
Well, you know who actually got the eight-hour day and the five-day week established after decades of labor advocation and activism to try to get it to happen? You know who actually did it?
I did, and I'm blanking out totally. Tell us.
Henry Ford.
Right.
Because he discovered he had people working 6 days a week, and he discovered, well, you get the same production out of them for 8 hours a day for 5 days a week. So let's go to that. And he also raised pay, practically doubled the pay, because then his employees could afford to buy his cars.
If they only worked 5 days a week, they'd have reasons to want to drive cars for over the weekend and
exactly.
Even sure.
So the powers that be, yeah, some of them will oppose it, but you know, it's like solar power. If you look around a bit, you'll find that big insurance companies, big bank study groups like Citibank, and I can point you at a bunch of others, have been saying for like 4 or 5 years now things like, get on board with the electric vehicle revolution. And Edison Electric Institute, which is the think tank for the electric utility industry, in 2013 put out a report spelling out in no uncertain terms, if you don't start doing this yourself, solar power is going to eat your lunch, because when does it generate the most? In the middle of the afternoon, which is when you're charging people the most, and you can't stop it. People will be doing it anyway. So if you don't get ahead of the curve and do it, Southern Company, Tom Fanning, I don't mind talking about him, the CEO of Southern Company, for many years he was saying, oh, solar power, maybe we'll do it at the end of the decade. And in 2015, because of a number of things that we just discussed, he decided that not only was Southern Company going to actually start selling solar power, he announced that in 2016, but he now goes around saying, okay, people want it, I'm going to sell it. And if other people are going to do it, I'm going to get ahead and I'm going to lead the market. So there's an example. It's kind of like the Alton Energy case way back in 2003. Even Mighty Southern Company, one of the largest electric utilities in the country, I think Duke currently is larger because they acquired something more recently, but one of the largest electric utilities in the country, is now claiming it wants to lead the solar power market.
Oh, you also have to get the public on board, though. For instance, I know people who, a friend of mine who lives back and forth to Florida, he's the snowbird. And even if he could have the hybrid Toyota for the same price as his gas-driven one, he wouldn't do it because he gives up half of his trunk, and he won't make that change. And so we have to.
Prius is pretty big.
So we have to do more.
I don't know why it says that.
We have to do more with the technology. We have to do more in public education also.
Right. So, I don't know whether he's right or not about the trunk size. It may be a perception problem, which is a huge part of the problem. You know, when I say, you know, the policymakers don't understand exponential growth, the general public doesn't either. The most common reaction we get when we go around the county commissions talking about that stupid pipeline is, well, we got to have the energy. Well, actually, no, we don't, for two reasons. One, as Florida Power and Light, whose customers are supposed to pay for that $3.2 billion boondoggle, the Sabal Trail pipeline through Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, every year FPL has to file with the Florida Public Service Commission a 10-year plan, and in the one they filed in 2016, it says, in boldface, in the executive summary, Florida needs no new electricity until 2024. Which completely does away with their excuse in 2013. That was their excuse for Sabal Trail. So, no, we don't need the energy. We don't need the pipeline for that reason. And also because, you know, solar power having won the economic battle already, we don't need any new pipelines.
Are you getting...
People don't understand that.
Are you getting the same publicity and protest that the Dakota pipeline has gotten?
DAPL has, Dakota Access Pipeline, DAPL as we call it, has inspired a lot of people all over Florida. I actually got quoted recently by Florida Bulldog. It's a very nice investigative group. You should read it. As saying that Florida is now stirred up like an ant bed by a 600-mile-long pipeline stick. And part of what stirred it up is seeing what was going on in Standing Rock. Yes, they have had camps. There's still some going on, but that's actually a small part of the activity. A lot of it is the divestment movement. Remember me talking earlier about Ticket to Wall Street way back in 1979, which kicked off getting the investors to pull out of nuclear? Well, the same thing's happening with pipelines. And this was also inspired in Florida by DAPL. I don't know if you're aware, two of the big investors in the DAPL project have pulled out.
Okay.
So there's events going on all of the time all over Florida, and it's many of the same banks, Bank of America, State Street, Wells Fargo, I don't mind naming them. There's others, but those are the big ones. And also outfits like, have you ever heard of Virginia 529? Okay, they're the biggest 529 fund in the country, which is for savings for when parents have a child, they and their grandparents put money in hoping there'll be college funds when the time comes. Well, VA 529 is also the biggest mutual fund stockholder in Spectra Energy, the pipeline company.
Okay.
So we wrote a letter to VA 529 just before their investment committee meeting and their board meeting, and a bunch of students from the University of Florida as well. And we actually got an answer. They were trying to pass the buck. Well, we don't do, socially responsible investing except for this one little tiny fund, which misses half the point from the letter. Your investors, VA 529, if you're listening, they don't want you invested in stranded assets. And that's what pipeline companies are going to be in far fewer years than a lot of people believe. And I didn't invent the stranded asset phrase. There's, big insurers and big banks who have latched on to that because it's going to happen, just like big coal. Natural gas is going down.
Supposedly, one of the Indian Point concerns, and I haven't read much about it, is there's supposed to be a pipeline going under the Hudson River that's too close to Indian Point too. So that's another problem.
Same company, Spectra Energy, the same one that's building the Sabal Trail pipeline.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Same one behind Algonquin Incremental Management. Same one behind, there's a long list.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about John Quarterman?
Join your local waterkeeper, in our case, Suwannee Riverkeeper. You do not actually have to be local. You do not have to be in our watersheds. We have members from as far away as New York State and California. So we're online. Look at SuwanneeRiverkeeper.org. And we think it's a great thing. One thing that makes riverkeepers great is water issues across the entire political spectrum. Case in point, in March 2016, just last year, the Georgia House of Representatives voted by an unheard-of margin of 128-34, never seen on any environmental issue before, to deny easements for Sable Trail to drill under Georgia rivers. That's because of two things, water and eminent domain, all party lines, the whole political spectrum. Unfortunately, it turns out the State Lands Commission did not actually need formal approval by the legislature, so the pipeline company got the easements anyway. But the point remains, if the Georgia House of Representatives can vote by such a lopsided margin against the pipeline, anybody can.
Yeah.
And well, for solar, remember, the people of Florida just in November made it clear they want solar. The people of Georgia already made it clear and made Georgia the fastest growing U.S. solar market. Solar now, no pipelines.
That's interesting because one normally thinks of Georgia as a very conservative state.
It is and it isn't. It's actually close to 50-50. That's a long story. Georgia became within 4 points of going for Obama in 2008. So,
okay.
Which is as close as the Senate race that was going on in Massachusetts at the same time. So Georgia can surprise you. It's in many ways a purple state. Of course, I live in deep red, deepest South Georgia. But even so, Wyoming County was also about 50-50 in that election.
My only experience with Georgia, we used to have the place years ago in Hilton Head, and we spent a bunch of time in Savannah. And I have some IBM friends who were in the Atlanta area, but I've got limited knowledge of Georgia as an overall state.
Atlanta is to Georgia like New York City is to New York State.
Right.
It thinks it's everything, but it isn't, and the rest of the state does not agree.
Yeah, and in New York, it was New York City and Buffalo, where your wife's from. They're the big Democratic strongholds. Then all the rest is not. So, thank you, John. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you for calling. Thank you for doing the show, and keep up the good work.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog to medium.com and publish the daily newspaper mentioned above. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Stacey Horn, and every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings. And back to Henry Mancini. Take us out of here, Henry. Cue Henry Mancini. There he comes. Good night, everybody. Good night again, John. Thank you.
All righty. Good night.